Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that has been known to display a wide range of emotions, though rage has so far not been among them. The emotion that's uppermost in our minds this week is our joy at welcoming back the third of our critical triad, Mary Pat Truthart. Welcome back, MP.
Thanks, Dan.
It's a good thing the three of us dutifully avoid rage in our commentaries, but it's especially so in a week that features our discussing two films that focus on characters who have every reason to feel racked by rage. The first is the protagonist of The White Tiger, a film by Iranian-American filmmaker Rahman Barani. The second, directed by Kevin MacDonald, is The Mauritanian, which is based on real events. Let's begin this week's show by delving into the life of a low-caste Indian man who chafes at what to him appears to be nothing more than a life of servitude. According to the 2008 novel by Indian-born writer Aravind Adiga, a white tiger is something special, a creature that shows up only once in 100 years. Applied to a human being, it means that person is bound for greatness. But as Balram, a boy born in a low-caste family living in a remote Indian village, quickly discovers, being special is no substitute for having connections. And when Balram's hopes for an education are dashed, he begins to understand his place in the world. He lives, he sees, in a virtual chicken coop, destined to always serve those in power, as have historically the others in his caste. But Balram isn't content with that lot. And beginning with his desperate quest to become a driver for the family that lives off his entire village, he begins his slow rise, one that can't avoid a couple of extremely dark turns. Adapted by director Barani from Aniga's novel, The White Tiger captures the simmering, and here's this word again, rage of India's so-called lower classes. And Balram's narration, which is devised as a letter he's writing to the visiting Chinese premier, accompanies everything we see on screen, giving us a firsthand view of the psychology behind his every action and the larger meaning behind both Adiga's novel and Barani's film.
Yeah, Barani is an interesting filmmaker, and I was kind of trying to think how this movie, The White Tiger, sort of fits into his filmography at large. And I mean, I think a simplistic reading of this movie is that it's about capitalism and it's about the destructive forces of capitalism. Of course, it's more specific than that because it's also about class and wealth within the caste system of India. And we can talk more about that, I suppose. But I think that, you know, sort of this idea of people being pushed to the sidelines because they don't have those connections, either, you know, because of family connections or monetary restrictions. I mean, that's been a running theme throughout his career, going all the way back to something like Man Pushcart, which was about a guy selling coffee in Manhattan on the street, to one of his more mainstream movies, 99 Homes, which is about the Great Recession and, you know, sort of the real estate bubble popping. And this movie, The White Tiger, has some of those similar themes, although, like I said, it's more specific, it's more focused on India specifically and how that country functions. I think that you use that word rage, and I almost wish this movie had been angrier, maybe messier in a way. It's very structured. I mean, it has this kind of running theme of him writing this letter explaining his life, which I'm sure, I haven't read the book this is based on, but I'm sure that's taken right from the novel. And I sort of wish that this had maybe been driven by a more palpable anger in a way, although it does, you know, we do see it kind of bubble up. And that's kind of the great conflict of this film, is that the main character has to remain servile. He has to remain functionary, even though he realizes he's being taken advantage of and there's nothing that he can do about it. And then when finally he does do something about it, it's seemingly out of character for him, but we kind of understand how it builds to that. So I liked this movie. I was taken along by it and entertained by it. I think it's reaching for greatness, and I don't think it quite gets there, and I'm not totally sure why, but in talking about it right now, I think that might be it. The sense that Barani is almost too buttoned up a filmmaker for this kind of movie to kind of break out and really kind of slap us across the face with this very, I think at the end, this very kind of despairing message about how one is able to kind of climb the social ladder. It reminds me a lot of Scorsese, some of Scorsese's films, the Wolf of Wall Street in particular. I mean, the message that movie leaves you at the end is, you know, it's not a hopeful one. And I don't think this movie is hopeful either, even though it kind of has those rags to riches trappings. So I think this mostly works. It's really well made. It's really well acted. But yeah, it's not great, but it's very good. And I think it continues, you know, a streak of Barani's films being very perceptive about character, being very perceptive about class and about money and how money is passed about. So yeah, this mostly worked for me, I have to say.
And let's face facts, this is not a Hollywood film. So I think that was difficult for some people to appreciate, because I know talking about this film with friends of ours, people were sort of put off by it. And I don't know, in some instances, it seemed the pacing maybe was a little uneven by some people's point of view. I also think that, Nathan, as you point out, I mean, it is sort of a turnabout is fair play kind of scenario, mm-hmm. but in the end, it doesn't really end up there, because when our protagonist, you know, makes his way through the ranks, we expect him to maybe treat his business and his employees differently. And he does until he doesn't. And so I think that's sort of the co-opting that occurs when you find yourself in a situation, perhaps unexpectedly or perhaps strategically, to change places with those that you've aspired to become, you know, throughout your entire life. I do think that many of the scenes capture that sort of authenticity of New Delhi in particular, because that city in and of itself is a sort of microcosm of contrasts. And so I thought that Barani did an excellent job of sort of capturing that aspect of things.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to address your notion, Nathan, and I'll do it in a very angry way. No, yeah. I wanted to address your notion of you thought the film wasn't great. And I agree with that. But I think it's great-ish. I think it's moving in that direction. And I think that Barani, and I agree with you, Barani is a skilled filmmaker. I mean, I have no problem with the pacing. I had no problem with the acting. I had no problem with the cinematography. I had really no problem with much of the film, except that there is this darkness to it that just doesn't have any hope. And in that sense, I don't know, is it something that each of us who sees it can bring our own interpretation to it? I mean, is it hopelessness? Is it reality? Is it a study of capitalism? My reaction to your thought that you wanted the film to be more angry, I actually appreciated the fact that the film was portraying this sense of rage by the so-called lower classes in a matter-of-fact manner. I didn't mind the fact that it wasn't as angry. I thought the contrast of that worked quite well. And we can't go any further before we mention the lead performance by an Indian actor. I've never seen him before, Ardash Gurav as Balram. If it's going to work at all, he carries it, because he's in virtually every scene and he narrates the whole thing. And I thought he did a superb job.
Yeah, it really lives and dies by his performance, doesn't it? It's one of those roles. And I agree with you that it's good. And going back to that notion of I wanted this to be angrier, I guess now that I'm thinking about it, I mean, maybe it's in keeping with sort of the barely repressed rage that this character has to carry around with him day in, day out. I mean, the indignities that he faces just in this job, I mean, the fact that he is like down on his hands and knees rubbing the calves of this guy that he works for, and he's like getting kicked in the face when he doesn't do the right thing. I mean, it's just, he's treated like a piece of furniture, essentially. And he has to ferry these people around and they don't appreciate him at all. And even the, you know, the American bred family members that come in and treat him like more of a human being, they're still kind of rude towards him too and insensitive towards him. So I guess maybe it would make sense that the movie would have that tone and that attitude, because it is driven by this guy's narration, by this guy's worldview. So I suppose that kind of makes sense. But at the end too, I mean, it's that whole idea of, you know, nobody goes into business, at least I hope so, you know, to make the world a worse place. I think even these evil corporations that we have probably started off with good intentions at some point. And that's kind of what this movie is about too, because he wants to make the world a better place. He sees what it's like to be a driver, to be a servant, and the indignities that they face. And so he's going to run this company and do it humanely. But is that even possible, you know, once you have that amount of wealth? And the movie kind of argues that no, it really isn't possible.
That was the impression that I had as well. And I do think that I'm not sure that the contrast between life in the US and life in India that was brought to the fore by the American Jonas, I'm not sure that worked completely, because we wanted to have somebody to identify with and root for in this movie. And there are these secondary characters like the grandmother who lives in the village, who sort of represents like old school, old time, but yet at the same time, she's willing to take advantage of the financial resources that are brought about by her grandson's sort of being co-opted into this system.
Yeah, she wants to victimize him even more so than the people who he works for.
Yeah, he couldn't get a break at any point. I mean, he does have some relationships with the other people who he works with, but we really don't see a whole lot about his interior life. And that maybe is someplace that the filmmaker could have gone a bit more.
That was The White Tiger. And this is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts and Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at The Mauritanian. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Hi, this is Lulu Garcia Navarro of Weekend Edition. Keeping apprised of the latest news is important, but we all need a break from the headlines. Whether it's a few precious minutes lost in a song, a hearty laugh at a conversation between comedians, or one of those driveway moments when a captivating story transports you somewhere far away, NPR and Spokane Public Radio are here for you. That's a public service you can count on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we count on you too. Contributing to this station keeps the programs you love on the air. Visit SpokanePublicRadio.org and click the red donate button to show your support today. And thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of this week's show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discussed The White Tiger. Let's now move to The Mauritanian. Shortly after the events of 9/11, a Mauritanian citizen named Mohamedou Ould Slahi was picked up by that West African country's authorities and questioned both by them and by the American FBI. A former member of Al-Qaeda, Slahi was suspected of having been an Al-Qaeda recruiter. He was then transferred first to a Jordanian prison, then on to the U.S. military base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. There he was held for, and this is the kicker, 14 years. Director Kevin McDonald, working from a script adapted from Slahi's 2015 memoir, Guantanamo Diary, gives us his version of Slahi's story. It features appearances by two A-list actors, two-time Oscar winner Jodie Foster, who portrays the attorney who takes on Slahi's defense, and Benedict Cumberbatch, who portrays the government's marine prosecutor and a man who ultimately refused to continue on the case because of what he claimed was government misconduct. The powerhouse performance, however, is put in by the Algerian-French actor Tahar Rahim, who shows what effects such a long period of incarceration, not to mention the various techniques of torture, would have on anyone. If nothing else, in that context, The Mauritanian is a chilling tale of legal ambiguity.
I think it's interesting that you focused on the ambiguity aspect, because I think this seems like a classic human rights violation portrayal of what we did, and I'm saying the U.S. did in Guantanamo Bay in holding people captive and using extraordinary interrogation techniques. And so the film does portray that, but the film really is about this individual experience of the Mauritanian and of the lawyer, Nancy Hollander, who represents him, and the Marine lawyer, as you point out. So it's posed against this backdrop of what's happening writ large, but it really is a smaller story in some respects. My first concern about the movie is I'm not exactly sure why Kevin MacDonald, who's a documentary filmmaker, at least in part, or some of his most notable productions have been documentary films, why he sort of took this fictionalized approach in the way that he did to this story, because I think that the actual events are even more powerful than they're portrayed here. But like I said, I've decided it was because he wanted to show the sort of intimate aspects of the relationships among the people and so forth. I do think that Nancy Hollander, some people might remember this, it's been probably 10 years ago now, but she wrote a really intriguing op-ed piece for the New York Times. And she basically said, people have been calling me a terrorist lawyer. And she said, if that means I defend people who are accused of terrorism, you're right. But when I defend people who are accused of child rape, nobody calls me a child rapist lawyer, or nobody calls me defending people who are selling nuclear secrets, because she also represented Chelsea Manning at one point. So she's a pretty notable attorney in her own right, former president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and so forth. And quite frankly, Jodie Foster nails her in her performance. She nails Nancy Hollander completely. The problem I had is, I think the title, The Mauritanian, is off-putting to people. And I'm afraid that people are not necessarily going to gravitate toward this film because it doesn't really have a context or a meaning for anyone. As a matter of fact, Dan, I think you said at one point, we were having a discussion about exactly where Mauritania was located.
Yeah, I had to look it up.
And I said, you know, hey, it's south of Morocco and so forth. But the performances are the reason why to watch this film. Jodie Foster, Benedict Cumberbatch,
Tahar Rahim, who we first saw
in The Prophet.
In The Prophet in 2009, an amazing performance.
And Shailene Woodley. I think that if you know nothing about what happened in Guantanamo Bay, I do think, much like Hotel Rwanda, this will be a nice introduction or a retrospective on what unfortunately is still happening there to some extent. And so I like the film for that reason as well. I think it's going to be accessible to people if they know what it's about, because I'm not sure that the title tells us.
Well, I mean, the problem though is that this is about a third of the movie that Hotel Rwanda was. I didn't really like this. I'm still kind of working out why. And I think it's because you can't really tell the story like this with any kind of subtlety or ambiguity. I mean, you said that there's legal ambiguity here, and that may very well be the case. But I think in terms of what happened to this guy, it's just horrible things happened to him, and then the story's over. And you mentioned MacDonald's documentary background, and he also famously made The Last King of Scotland, a narrative film that won Forest Whitaker his Oscar. This movie ends with documentary footage of the real people interacting. And that was so much more compelling. It's about 90 seconds of footage at the end, and then he like sings a Bob Dylan song over the end credits. That was so much more compelling than anything that happens in the movie. And it did make me wish that MacDonald had made a documentary about this, because I think it is an important story. I just don't know if you can dramatize it that effectively. And I mean, we've just seen this movie a million times before in so many other iterations. And it's scenes of the lawyers in the rooms with the boxes of papers and all the redacted materials. And then on the prosecution side, you have Benedict Cumberbatch slowly realizing that maybe he's on the wrong side of history. And that character, I think, is just a total cliche, the way that it's written and acted. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, you're right. The performances are really good. And the main guy, the Mauritanian of the title, he's the best thing in the movie. And I think his story, like I said, it's important. There's a reason that his story has been translated into, you know, 100 different languages. But the way this story was told to me, it just felt very procedural 101. Like I feel like we've seen this movie about this era of history so many times. It reminded me of that movie, what was it called? The Report, with Adam Driver and Annette Bening. And that, I mean, this is better than that. That was so dry that it almost felt like you were reading case files.
The transcript.
Yeah. This is better than that, but I don't know. I just feel like this particular era of history has been told better, and mostly in documentaries. I mean, if you want to see a really good film about Guantanamo, see Errol Morris's film, Standard Operating Procedure. I think that is the powerful Guantanamo film that I think came out of all of this?
Well, and I think it is hard because we do know. So to talk about Kevin MacDonald a little bit, I mean, you mentioned The Last King of Scotland, but, you know, he won an Academy Award for his first film about, you know, the Israeli, the massacre of the Israeli
One Day in September, I think it was called.
And yeah, then he also did a Bob Marley doc. He did a Whitney Houston doc. Yeah. He did that incredible climbing doc, Touching the Blade.
Oh, man.
And so that was sort of my takeaway. And I was trying to eliminate my bias about preferring docs, if at all possible. And here we have a documentary filmmaker who could have done something more compelling, I guess.
Well, it doesn't help that he teases us with a mini documentary at the end of this movie going, hey, he could have been watching this the whole time. At least. No, and no offense to Jodie Foster, who's great in everything and won the Golden Globe for this, but yeah.
Well, that was our discussion about the Mauritanian. Before we go this week, this weekend marks another kind of break in this long
COVID pandemic.
The Magic Lantern is opening, and they're going to be screening two films that are Oscar nominated. One is Nomadland, the Chloe Zhao film, and Minari, the Isaac Chung film, both of which have had multiple nominations and have won multiple awards. I think Golden Globes, and they've had attention all over the place. So if you haven't yet seen either of those movies, I think the three of us would give a hearty recommendation. Go masked, go back to the Met Lantern, support the Lantern, and see a pair of really good movies. And,
but remember, you're not in your living room.
please
don't talk.
And two distinctly American stories too. And both about, you know, sort of the American landscape and what it looks like to both outsiders and natives. And I saw both of those. I mean, I think we all saw them on small screens. It would be great. I think they would both look beautiful on the big screen. I can't wait to go back, get some popcorn, and be around. I can't believe I'm saying this. I can't wait to be around people again.
Oh my goodness.
No, I'm not going to go that far, but to see movies on a big screen.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And so that's it for this week's edition of Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed The White Tiger. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the novelist Aravind Adiga. See, the poor dream all their lives of getting enough to eat and looking like the rich. And what do the rich dream of? Losing weight and looking like the poor. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.